It's Monday, May the 24th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a new breed of female entrepreneurs, horses, how they're helping people with therapy. The extraordinary decision of the Belarus authorities to ground a plane and arrest a so-called dissident journalist. Huge international ramifications. But first, it can be up to 3 years delayed to see an NHS dentist. So dental patients are being forced to wait for up to 3 years for NHS appointments, while the same practices offer appointments within a week to those who pay privately. Research by Healthwatch England shows thousands on waiting lists, and watchdogs say that people have pulled out their own teeth even and done do-it-yourself fillings as a result. I'm joined now by Jacob Lant, who is Head of Policy Partnerships and Research at Healthwatch England. Jacob, this is pretty scandalous. Is it anything to do with the pandemic?
So yes, it really is actually. We've seen over the last 9 months in particular, a year or so, scale of problems being raised about dentistry have been off the charts. So to paint a picture for your listeners, prior to the pandemic, about 5% of the feedback that Healthwatch get from the public was about dentistry, and that's jumped to 20%. So it's a fifth of all of what we're hearing is about dentistry. And we cover everything from care homes and surgery to GPs. So you can imagine kind of 20% of our feedback about dentistry shows the scale of the problem. But there are a number of issues that were existing prior to the pandemic, in particular the number of dentists we have in the country, the amount of money and investment the NHS is putting in dental services, the information out there available to people to help them find a dentist. All of this stuff was a problem pre the pandemic. So it's really laid it bare, all the problems, but we've sown the seeds for some time, the crisis we're currently experiencing.
It's quite interesting that the number of dental surgeries offering NHS treatment fell from 9,600 in 2014-15 to 8,400 in 2019-2020. Why are so few dental practices offering NHS treatment? Is it because they can simply make a lot more money privately?
I think that it's a very real challenge that, you know, dentists, they have to operate as businesses, and the NHS needs to be funding them in order to provide that treatment to people on the NHS. I think they can make more money from private treatment, but actually we know most dentists want to just be able to provide care to people, and they need a contracting system in the NHS that incentivizes them to be able to give care to people as they need it. And also not just treatment, this has to be routine and regular care to help people keep, you know, a healthy mouth all the time.
And is it really true that some people are actually pulling out their own teeth?
Well, yes, unfortunately it is. And I will just be clear, it's not a huge number of cases where we hear that happening. That is the extreme cases. Mm. But even so, it should never happen. I mean, we have heard of people sort of doing all sorts of self-medication, and particularly during the pandemic. So everything from taking lots of painkillers and combining that with alcohol, which is a dreadful idea, and I said led to some cases being admitted to hospital, to A&E, for example, overdosing. We have heard people doing, pulling out their own teeth, and it should never get to that state. People should never be left in that level of pain. And practices right now are still prioritising urgent emergency care. But we know that there can still be waiting lists for that. So we heard people waiting up to 6 weeks for urgent emergency treatment on the NHS for dentistry. And that just can't continue. We need to be getting people who are in pain and need urgent care, getting that right away, really, so that they don't resort to such measures.
And the fact is, Jacob, toothache can be one of the most unbearable pains that we can experience. So the idea you may have to wait 6 weeks or months to get your tooth sorted out when you're in huge pain, I guess that's why sometimes people then, they're so desperate, they pay to go privately, or worse still, they try and fix the problem themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that is very true that people do. I mean, the cost to go private is very expensive often. But that's not to say that the NHS treatment isn't expensive either. So 3 out of 5 people who we spoke to as part of this research said that they think the NHS charges themselves are expensive. And it's not just putting off treatment, it's also putting off routine care. So people going and making sure that they don't get into a position where they have a problem that causes them significant pain. And obviously, during the pandemic, we've had to all be sort of working with the restrictions that have been imposed on all of us. But actually, as we emerge out of the pandemic, we need to make sure that we're tackling the dental crisis and that people aren't left in pain, and they aren't left taking either drastic measures or, you know, facing crippling debts as a result of having to go for private dental treatments.
So what's the answer? The government have to spend more money on dentistry? Has it become like a Cinderella of the NHS?
Well, there are a couple of solutions. I think the first thing to note is that the system does need reforming. We know that there's been conversations going on about reform of dentistry since 2009. It's now 2021. And frankly, that's been going on for far too long. So the first thing we need to do is get a lot more speed and urgency about fixing this problem. And we also need to be more ambitious. So we can't just think about going back to how things were prior to the pandemic, because I was saying, although it's exploded in recent months as an issue, we've sown the seeds of this for some time. So we have to be more ambitious. And some of that will be investing more money in dentistry. Some of it will be recruiting more dentists. It will also be making sure that we're, you know, the NHS is making a better assessment of the level of need in different parts of the country. So we get the right number of dentists, the right number of dentist appointments available in different areas so people can access care and they can find it easily. I mean, just even the NHS website alone is a big area for improvement. So we know people going on there looking for a dentist can end up contacting 20 or 30 dentists in their local area before they find someone taking on new NHS patients. And that's because the information is just so woefully out of date. So there's a whole range of things, fixes that can be done. And it's not just money, but ultimately we do need to put more focus and investment on dentistry to fix this crisis.
Absolutely. You made me realise, Jacob, I haven't been to the dentist for a while. I'm going to see if I can get an appointment. Hopefully I won't have to wait 3 years. That's Jacob Lant. He's head of policy partnerships and research at Healthwatch England, which has done this extraordinary research on dentistry. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. A Ryanair flight has been intercepted by a fighter jet and forced to land in Belarus, where a dissident journalist was then arrested. Roman Protasevich was on a wanted list in the country after organising mass protests against President Alexander Lukashenko last year. He now faces up to 15 years in prison. The British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab and the EU President Ursula von der Leyen have both condemned the move. I'm joined now by Aisha Jung, who's Amnesty International senior campaigner on Belarus. Aisha, I find this absolutely jaw-dropping that a country has done this. Can any country now ever permit any of its airlines to fly over Belarus airspace?
I think we've all found this jaw-dropping. And I know that Lithuania is already looking into halting its civilian planes from flying over Belarusian airspace for exactly this reason. The plane was actually closer to, I believe it was only a few miles away from landing in Vilnius at the time that it was forced by the fighter jet to turn back and head towards Minsk. I think it's important to, what this whole episode does is illustrate the lengths to which the Belarusian authorities are currently ignoring violating their obligations under their own laws and also international laws. So we've been highlighting that for the last year in terms of their obligations under international human rights law. But in doing what they've done yesterday, they've taken it to a whole new level and are no doubt violating all sorts of international norms and regulations and laws.
It's an overt attack on democracy. What do you think Britain's foreign secretary has protested, as has the European Commission president? What practical steps should we be now taking as a country to make our displeasure known?
I think the international community and the response from the international community has been strong, and I understand also the International Civil Aviation Organization has responded strongly. I've no doubt Ryanair will also be making their opinions heard and investigating the entire episode. We, as Amnesty International, of course, we only speak in terms of the human rights obligations of Belarus. And again, what this incident illustrates, there are hundreds of people within Belarus, within the borders of Belarus, who have faced similarly and are facing similarly outlandish accusations and criminal prosecution for the same reasons that Roman Protasevich is, which is for peacefully exercising their rights to freedom of expression and assembly and association. And hundreds are currently in detention. He will be joining hundreds of his peers in detention, facing criminal prosecution, and hundreds have already been sentenced to prison terms. So the risks of when people say he is facing a 15-year prison sentence, he really is facing a 15-year prison sentence, and many have already been given those sentences over the course of the last year in this current clampdown that we're seeing on the part of the Belarusian authorities.
Can Lukashenko be shamed into doing anything? Is he completely indifferent to public opinion, international public opinion?
It would appear, in terms of Belarus's record on civil and political rights, they were already faring quite poorly. And as I said, in the last year, they have taken that to a whole new level, and certainly our experience of engagement with the Belarusian authorities has deteriorated significantly in the last year, and there does seem to be very little regard for their obligations under international law and certainly human rights law. What pressure can be brought to bear, I believe there are avenues, but as I said, we speak really just in terms of human rights. But certainly, I know that the international community, in terms of sanctions that governments are bringing, and increasingly, and what we've seen recently, of course, is the withdrawal, of Belarus from the Eurovision Song Contest, which brings its own pressure in certain fields. And also, they recently had the International Ice Hockey World Championships were also recently withdrawn from Belarus due to the human rights situation. And I know, so there is collective effort that can be brought through any number of fields and means to try to get the Belarusian authorities to see sense and to act in accordance with their human rights obligations.
And you just hope that they do achieve something, Aisha, because otherwise other dictators like Lukashenko may decide that they're going to try the same sort of tactic too, which would be a disaster for international aviation.
Absolutely agree. And the important thing is the collective effort and the coordinated effort and to keep the pressure up. And that's certainly what we intend to be doing. We would hope to see that same response from the international community.
All right. That's Aisha Jung. She's Amnesty International senior campaigner on Belarus. Thanks for joining us. So visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. Frontline NHS workers have used horse therapy to recover from trauma caused by the pandemic. Dina Shale runs Equine Therapy Centre The Way of the Horse, where horses are used to help people identify, process and heal trauma, and is treating a growing number of NHS workers. She joins me now. Dina, horses have always been very sensitive to human emotions, but how did you work out that they could be utilised to help people in therapy?
Well, I travelled all over the country looking for methods to be able to heal my own trauma with horses, and I came across a method that originally is from America. And I trained in this method, and then I went to America to train with the lady that wrote the book that inspired me to go on a journey of healing. And I recognized through the training that horses are sentient creatures, and they're able to sense what's happening in our own autonomic nervous system. So through the training that we've done and through the specialists that we now employ on our programs, we're able to teach people how trauma affects your nervous system and not just your mind.
Right. And you've got 10 therapy horses, 8 of which are rescue ponies. What exactly do they do, the horses, and how do they interact with the people seeking therapy?
So if you put a human with a horse, the horse will do something called body scanning. And body scanning is their method of staying safe in the wild. So these tools that we are teaching people are things that have a part of our evolution. We would have done the similar types of things to the horses in the wild in sensing what was happening in our environment. Now, horses still do this because they're a prey animal. And I think that's what the magical word is, really, with this work that we do. People say to me, you know, many times, why horses? Why do you use horses? And horses are a prey animal. And so they sense, they're very, very sensitive to humans, change of heartbeat, change of nervous system. So when your body starts to go into a stress response, they're able to recognize that because that's their job. The evolution of the horse is that they are able to sense what's happening in their environment to stay safe in the wild. And so we would set up a scenario with the horse and put the human from the theories that we teach them in with the horse. And then we would show them how their body language and their body sensations affect the horse. So we teach quite a bit of theory about trauma, about stress, about the brain, and how the body processes all of those types of things. And then we show people with the horse. And that's the magic of how it actually works. And it's really difficult to talk about it. Mm. It's much easier to show you.
Well, it's interesting. I see that you said with your own horse, Beauty, you couldn't climb on her or get too close if you were angry or stressed. She could sense that. So you had to calm down, literally had to physically calm down if you wanted to spend any quality time with her.
Yeah, and this has been reiterated with a horse that we bought quite a few years ago called Big Harry that started us from the business off. And he was an ex-show jumper, thoroughbred, so he was highly spirited and highly sensitive to his environment. And so when I used to ride him as well, he would swish his tail about, he would throw his head around, and he would show me how nervous I was. So when I was then able to learn to tune into my own emotional state and be able to calm my nervous system and all those butterflies that goes on in your tummy, he was a much better horse to ride. But I had to control myself rather than him. And I learned so much from working with this ex-show jumping horse that had a breakdown equally, because he was super sensitive to his environment, just like we are when we've experienced trauma, because we can go into that flight and fight mechanism when we're in a stress response as well, just as they do.
And last year, I think you received funding from the National Lottery.
Yes, we were absolutely so grateful to the National Lottery Community Foundation, because they actually believed in our project, and we went through quite a rigorous set of a process that they have to actually get the lottery funding. It, you know, it's not an easy task to do, but they actually really believed in the project that we set out to deliver to people. And we received 250,000, which was a 3-year, 2-day course. So we run the project for 2 days a week. Those sessions that we deliver to people, and we have 12 sessions a day, are funded by the National Lottery. So, we're very grateful to them, because that has obviously helped us to be able to help the people through the pandemic, because the lottery funding that we had came just at the beginning of the first lockdown. So we've actually delivered this project now in 3 different ways. And what that's helped us to do is realize that actually we can teach a lot of what we teach people online, because the science and the psychology and psychotherapy we teach, the we're able to teach that online, and then, you know, that's helped us create a new program for people that can't attend the site, or maybe don't like horses or are scared of horses. And so we're still able to deliver this valuable work to people through our new project called Highway to Healing, which just takes people on their own healing journey. And if there's one thing that I've learned in my own healing journey through my trauma, is that that everybody has their own path, and what might work for one might not work for another. And so therefore, with the new program that we've developed, we are taking people and giving them options for what feels right for you. You know, what is it that's going to calm your nervous system down? And obviously that's something that has been quite hot in the press over the weekend as well. You know, the nervous system is actually the secret to us being able to heal our trauma.
Absolutely. And so if people, so you're doing more and more online and helping more and more NHS workers online. So if people, Diana, are interested in this, how do they get in touch with you?
So we've got the two projects that we're running.
Yeah.
We've got the National Lottery Community Fund,
yeah,
which is at our Leicestershire site. And that is highlighted on our website. So that's www.thewayofthehorse.co.uk. And then the online program isn't funded, unfortunately, but we want more people to be aware of that project and come and find us. So we've got the website, which is www.highwaytohealing.co.uk, and we are on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter as well. So people can find us that way as well. But the Highway to Healing is the new one that we are launching in June, and that will have a number of specialists on that are specialists in understand how the brain works, how the body works, and how energy affects you and everything that is around you, as well as teaching people how the evolution of an animal can help us in our healing journey.
Very interesting. That's Dina Shale, who runs the Equine Therapy Centre, The Way of the Horse. So it's that time of the programme. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest sports news. Well, he did well, didn't he? Phil Mickelson is his first name?
Yeah.
He won the
USPGA.
USPGA, one of the majors.
One of the four majors, yeah.
At 51. Is that the oldest for a long time?
At the age of 50, yeah, he's 50, so yeah. Well, it's the oldest ever. So
is
the
it old, really?
The oldest ever major winner, yeah.
Wow.
Quite incredible, because, you know, he'd won five majors before.
Yeah.
Hadn't won his last for a fair few years, you know, and had been battling various things, like he's had arthritis, he's had various injuries and ailments down the years. And, you know, you just don't win majors at that age, you know, even
right.
In the 40s is pretty rare.
Yeah.
So to win one at 50 and become the oldest major winner ever was just a superb performance from him. He took the sort of lead on Saturday and he kept it, and he went into the final round on Sunday in the lead. And he held off the charge of Brooks Koepka, who's another American,
right,
who's a lot younger than him. And he managed to see it off and he managed to get the job done. Now, he didn't actually have a superb final round. He actually shot one over, so he had a sort of poor final round, but so did the others.
Right.
So he was able to...
Quite windy, wasn't it, the last day?
It was quite windy. It was very windy over the weekend, yeah, so it was tough.
Right.
Some people shot good scores, but he did enough. He basically did enough. And the scenes at the end were amazing. So, because there were fans back, obviously. And as he came down the 18th fairway to get to the putting surface to finish off, where it was already clear that he was going to win, all the crowd sort of swarmed on. He had to fight his way through this big crowd. I'm not sure it was very COVID safe, but
no, I'm sure it wasn't.
Had to fight his way through this crowd with the stewards trying to part the masses as he fought his way up to the green. So, and he's a very, very popular man.
Is
he's,
he?
He's an American, very
yeah.
popular man in the States, where
right.
he has a good rap for doing things like he stays behind after a round to sign lots of autographs and hang out with the kids and
good for
that
him.
Sort of thing.
And
so.
no Brit anywhere near it.
No Brit really. Justin Rose, maybe that's not true. We had a couple of Irishmen
right.
who did really well. So Lowry and Harrington,
okay,
did really well. So they finished in the top 10.
Right.
So that was one for the Irish to be very, very proud of. So they
yeah.
were up there. So yeah, they were both on 2 under. So only 4 shots off the lead in the end. Justin Rose was 1 under. So we had a few Brits up there, but. But yeah, sadly, Casey was on 200 as well, Paul Casey. Right. But okay. Sadly, no one challenging at the very top.
All right. Now, Leicester, that keenly fought last four plays, they lost it because they lost at home.
Yeah.
They won the cup.
Yeah, they won the cup the previous weekend.
Yeah.
All they had to do, as it turned out, was to beat Tottenham at home.
Yeah.
On the last game of the season, in front of their fans, were obviously back, and they came unstuck and they lost 4-2. And as it turned out, had they won, they would have been in the top four and they would have qualified for next season's Champions League, because Chelsea, meanwhile, were losing at Aston Villa. So it would have been in Leicester's hands to win and get into that fourth place. So after the glory and the high of winning the FA Cup the previous weekend, to then miss out, and they were 14 minutes away from being there when they conceded the goal and then let in two more late ones. But they've been in the top four all season.
Gosh, that's very disappointing for them.
Until 14 minutes to go.
And would the manager and would the team have preferred to be in the top four rather than winning the FA Cup?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, you would think most of them would prefer the silverware because, you know, you win an FA Cup and Leicester have never won an FA Cup before. So I think in terms of the Leicester players, yes, they would say they would prefer to win the FA Cup and not be in the top four if they had to choose. You know, on the flip side, you could say the Chelsea players have won the FA Cup quite a lot because they've got quite a good recent history in it. So for them, it's all about being the most prestigious, being the biggest club. So for them, being in the top four is probably seen as a bigger achievement. But no, certainly for Leicester, I think the FA Cup, which they'd never won before, was the thing. But still, to be 14 minutes away, having been there all season.
Very frustrating.
Very frustrating.
And Harry Kane, was that his last game for Tottenham Hotspur?
Well, that remains to be seen. He's in a very tough spot, Harry Kane. He's come out very publicly to say, obviously, as we know, how much he wants to leave, basically, just stopped short of saying that, but he basically has come out and said he wants to leave. Tottenham aren't very happy about that, the way he's gone public with it. So it remains to be seen that he's still got these 3 years left on his contract, of course. And we know that Daniel Levy, the Spurs chairman, is a very tough negotiator and will not let him walk away unless the price is right. And even
150
then,
million
150
pounds?
Mil, and it's even just, then.
Is the world gone mad?
Well, that's what they cost these days, these footballers. I know. Well, it is an extraordinary amount of money. But, you know, yeah, as I say, that's the kind of money they go for. And when you're, you know, the absolute best, which he is, won the Golden Boot again this season. So that's the third time he's been the Golden Boot winner, which obviously is
the player of the year?
Top scorer in the Premier League.
Okay.
That's the third time he's done it. Mm. So he's a man in demand. He's worth 150 mil, even if you don't think he is.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody is. Well, no, that's true. It just remains to be seen whether someone will stump up the cash. And if Manchester City
or Chelsea,
I cannot see him going to Chelsea. They're there. Tottenham's, as well as Arsenal, they are their arch rivals.
Right.
Daniel Levy wouldn't be able to walk down Tottenham High Street if he sold their star player to their arch rivals. It's almost like selling him to Arsenal. It just wouldn't happen. Man City or Manchester United, maybe he could get away with if the money's right and the Spurs fans know that their player wants to leave. So
now, you know how good you are at predictions. Make a tip. Where's he going? Where's he going to go?
I think he will start next season. I think he will finish next season as a Tottenham player.
Ah, interesting.
I think Levy will dig his heels in, and I don't think anyone will come up with enough money to tempt Levy to sell him. And I think we'll have one very unhappy England captain in a Tottenham shirt for one more season. I think then maybe he might sell him the following season. But, you know.
Well, you heard it here first. If Matt Gatwood says it,
it won't happen.
It's probably wrong.
Indeed.
Thanks for talking to us. Top female investors have lent their support to the Mayor's annual Aphrodite Award, given to a woman who has set up a business while her children are under 12. At present, only 1% of venture capital funding goes to businesses founded by all female teams. But a new generation of female investors aims to change that. I'm joined now by Dipali Nangia, who's venture partner at Speed Invest. Dipali, what is Speed Invest?
Thank you so much for having me. Speed Invest is actually a European venture capital fund. I'm a venture partner there. I was brought in really to turbocharge some of their diversity efforts, and my focus there is female founders, making sure that, you know, we are seeing a good pipeline of female founders coming in, and over time we're investing in more women as well. But separately from that, I was really, you know, mentioned in the article as an angel investor, because outside of Speed Invest, I also invest personally as well as a part of the Atomic War Injuries Program.
Yeah, sure. Is it a reluctance of the lenders to lend the money to women that's held women back, in your view, or is it just not enough women coming through with the ideas?
So firstly, currently it's not lending. What we're talking about here is equity financing.
Right.
It's a nuance, obviously, but it's not. Women aren't borrowing money, but they're asking for investment in
okay,
their business.
Sure.
So think about it like Dragon's Den, for instance. So when I first started investing in women, there was a pipeline issue. There weren't enough, women building large technology, scalable companies. But I feel that has significantly changed over the years. I mean, lots of female founders building, trying to build amazing companies in underserved markets, which could be, over time, large companies. So I definitely don't feel it's a pipeline issue anymore. But there are lots of nuances. There's lots of things I could probably go on and talk about more than which would take a long time.
And in your view, are female entrepreneurs better than men, or do they have different skills?
I mean, women tend to, be more thoughtful when it comes to, taking risk. They probably have a more calculated approach. They probably are more open to having a diverse team around them and, diversity of thought, diversity of leadership. They're more open to feedback. They're probably better mentors, when it comes to building teams. So there are lots of skills that women have that probably lend itself to, stronger businesses and stronger decision making. But having said that, I only look at, female-run businesses. So I'm not, I haven't looked at that many male-founded businesses, but definitely I feel that women have certain characteristics that lend them to be, better business leaders.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this report here. It says when they do secure investment, women's businesses show returns of 20% more revenue with 50% less money invested. That's according to a report from Barclays Bank.
Exactly. There's a fair amount of research that has been done, not just from the banking sector, but, the VC industry as well, in Silicon Valley as well as London. But, we need to see more and more female founders being funded and more women, either then going on to sell their companies or taking them public, and you see more capital flowing into female founders at that point.
And do you think women like investing in other women's businesses?
Super interesting. So, I co-founded something called Alma Angels in the UK with three other amazing co-founders. I was having a coffee with one of my friends one day, who's now one of my co-founders. And I said to her, when I'm on panels talking about angel investing, women come up to me and they ask me about, the fact that they want to learn about investing. And that's how Alma Angels was really born, because she turned around and said, why don't we do something about it? And that was the birth of the community that we now run, where we are essentially enabling and teaching more female investors to invest in other women. So Alma is set up for exactly that. And we have lots of women now who are first-time angel investors who are investing in other female founders.
Fascinating. Very interesting. That's Deepali Nandia, venture partner at Speed Invest. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.